Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 42, featuring José Alves da Silva and Andrew Hickenbottom. They were two attendees of THU that I went to, as you know, and we're continuing our THU series. José is an amazing concept artist, does incredible work. Ironically, also comes from an architecture background. As you guys already know, it's been an ongoing joke on the podcast. And Andrew Hickenbottom does a lot of incredible work, has a passion for pinup, and I am absolutely in love with his work and his ideas. So it was really, really incredible to have him there. We have a special guest with us today on the intro, Melissa Knight. Melissa, say hello.
Hello,
Melissa.
I feel like I need to wave, but that's not going to be much use.
Not, you know, you can wave, but but no one will hear you. So tell us, Melissa, this is your first week.
It is.
And what is your position at the company now?
Well, I've just arrived as the creative director of marketing.
Yes.
For the Chaos Group.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to be here.
And you've been in the industry for a long time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You make me sound really old, but it's true.
Well, we're all in that area. But she and I had a wonderful opportunity to go see The Walk yesterday in IMAX 3D, right?
We did. I turn up and we have an amazing field trip at work. Yeah. I want one every week now.
You're going to get a little spoiled. Mm-hmm. So it was really incredible to see The Walk. Probably one of the best ArcViz projects I've seen. It was really, really incredible to see. And if you want to know more about it, you guys can roll back to episode number 36 with Kevin Bailey, who's the visual effects supervisor on it, and check out more about it. It was all rendered in V-Ray for Katana using Google Cloud. So just a reminder to go check that out.
Yeah, it was incredible.
It was really incredible. And the building looks incredible, right?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
I think people forget that's the building is not there. Obviously, the building is not there. And so it was created in CG, and they used a GGX shader for a lot of the metal, and it turned out absolutely incredible. One last announcement I want to make is I will be at the 3D Symposium in Cancun, November 14th and 15th, and I'll be talking there. I think I'm going to be on a panel as well. So if you're there or you're going to be there, give me a heads up, and we should meet up while we're there. All right, guys. Thank you. Hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You guys haven't listened to any of these, have you?
I have.
You have?
Plenty of them.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't listen to that many podcasts at all, to be honest. You know, I just don't have a lot of time to listen to, because I think it's probably due to my hearing. It's like, I have to concentrate quite hard to hear people.
Okay.
So for me, it's kind of like I'd rather just listen to music, because you don't have to make words out. It's just like sounds, you know.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
I listen to a lot of podcasts while I'm working, especially while I'm sculpting. And you can sometimes almost turn your brain off. You're just doing hair like for the whole day, and you're just sculpting, and it just you can do two things with your brain at the same time.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah, it's true. Sometimes it's very soothing to sort of do that, to just sort of just listen to podcasts. My wife is a flame artist, and so she does, when she has to paint in flame, she's got to just mindlessly do the same frames over and over and flip. So she does do a lot of that.
It's like if you double your day.
Yeah.
In some way, you're
taking advantage. You're listening to a podcast.
I listen to your podcast and many podcasts that have to do, let's say, interviews with other artists, stuff that have to do with 3D techniques, and so you're kind of learning and executing at the same time. It's a time saver.
Yeah, absolutely. And you, I met you at the last Trojan Horse last year.
Yeah.
And then were you around last year too?
Yes, I was.
I don't remember if we met up or not.
Well, at least you photobombed our family photo.
I can't remember. There might have been alcohol
involved. We had the family, the THU family photo, and there was a photo that we were taking, me, you, Serge, and then on the back there's a guy staring with his mouth open.
It was me.
Yeah, actually, I do remember now.
Yes, I was here from the first edition.
Yeah,
because I think I met you in the lobby of the main hall, you know, where the main screen is. I think you were like wearing a VRO t-shirt or something like that, and you saw my name badge, and we got chatting. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. It was really cool. I love being here. It's kind of amazing. I mean, it hasn't even started yet, and I've already three days into it. This is my third day, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, this one will feel longer for sure.
Yeah, it'll feel really long, but it's going to be really cool. I mean, some of the speakers are incredible this year. I'm really already excited. I'm almost like when all the people are starting to get here and gather, and you know, yesterday at I could already sense that a lot of the people who have been to this before they've already gotten rid of their shyness, so they're teaching the other people to not be shy, and they're sitting there and asking questions. And you know, one of the things that I was kind of joking around is like, you know, someone looks at me, I forgot who it was, someone came up to me who I'd seen since last Trojan Horse, and he said, "Welcome home," you know, and that's kind of a real nice feeling to feel that way. You know?
Yeah, I guess that's how people feel that they've come back to their secret place.
For me, one of the big draws about coming back to THU was not so much, well, I mean, the speakers and the talks and everything, they're fantastic. But for me, arguably the biggest draw for me is just the community and like how friendly everybody is, and seeing all the people that you met last year.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like a great place to be. And then on top of that, you've got all of these talks and the recruitment things and the life draw. And yeah, it's just a nice place to be because you kind of like feel like you've come and did Troyer.
Yeah,
for like a week, and it's almost like Battle Royale, but without the killing.
Right,
you know,
right,
everybody's
right.
Kind of together, and you know.
Yeah,
but it's curious that Andrew has most of people that are here loves the event, but I was the guy who had to try to convince him to come.
Yeah, I'm generally not a big fan of like industry events and industry talk because it's very technical and it's. The stuff that I'm really passionate about is mostly 2D cartoony drawings like pinups and stuff like that. And when you get these kind of events, it's mostly like concept art and like VFX and realistic things like that. So it's almost kind of like not completely my scene, but it's such a good event. And even things that I'm not personally invested in, you know, like special effects for like dragons for Games of Thrones and stuff. I saw the talks for that and I thought it was really, really interesting. So you do get inspired even if it's not what you are personally like invested in. So it's just seeing everybody's talent, it kind of rubs off on you a bit and you go back home and you just want to do something.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to get to some of your talk from last year because I like I said, it was something I still talk about this day. And I love the fact that I can go to a place like THU and I can hear these talks. They're not the same talks. It's not a SIGGRAPH, right? It's not like that. And the SIGGRAPH is good and it has its place. And you know, so do all the other ones, FMXs and everything else. But this is about inspiration in a lot of ways. And I think that was a very good thing. And I learned so much about an art form, like the art form that you love and obsess about. I learned about it from you and how much history and all that stuff happened. And it was really an invigorating experience to me. So I'm really glad we could do that.
One of the main differences here, I think, is that the event puts the artist in the center.
Right.
I remember things like when, on the first edition, Aaron McBride from ILM was here. One of the things that I noticed that he was really happy about was that people were there to listen to Aaron McBride and not ILM.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, no.
I noticed that with Andrew Schmidt's talk because
there was a couple of guys from Pixar. There was like three or four of them, right?
I remember being excited because there was a guy from Pixar and obviously that's going to be a great talk, which it was. But I was quite surprised because it wasn't so much, this is what Pixar told me to say. It was his experience at Pixar and there was a lot of like personal stuff in there, like what it's like to really work there and like photos of like of some of the events around the office, and it was more insightful than like watching something on a DVD where they try and present it in the way that is controlled, you know. It was quite honest and real, and obviously Scott Ross, he was very frank on that opening talk about the state of the industry, and it's nice to get that kind of honesty.
Yeah.
Yes, it's good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've known Scott, and that's his thing. He's not afraid to say what he wants to say, and that's good. It's a good thing that Scott's been able to make this happen. To be honest, I know that sometimes he's a little bit bitter about the state of the industry, et cetera, and I don't blame him. Mm-hmm. But what he's created here, in a sense, him and Andre obviously together, but as a combination, he's created the idea that celebrates the artists again. And that's, I think, in my mind, and I'm going to say it's beyond the digital domains and ILMs and all the other stuff that he's done for the industry. I think that this is probably one of his greatest moments in terms of being able to make something like this happen, and people should celebrate. And people are still finding out about this. I know a lot of people are like, you know, that I know in the industry and VFX, and I say, you know, I'm going to THU, and it's like, what is that? I was like, oh my God, I just looked it up. It looks amazing. Why didn't I know about this? I was like, well, too late. You know, the tickets are sold out. But it's really kind of, it's great that it is. And like, you know, like I said, it's welcome home when I come here. So.
And that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
Is that, it's like you come home like to a sort of a, it's like your second home, really.
Yeah.
And you pass most of, I don't know Andy, but I know that throughout the year, there are many moments in which I think of what was the last year's CHU,
uh-huh.
and I'm eager to come to the next
yeah.
one.
And Louis was saying it too, and we all felt it. Like when we got on the ferry and came across, we were like, has it only been a year? Like we felt like we just, you know.
Yeah, there have been a lot of people that I haven't seen since last year's THU.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the friends that I made, they maybe came to London or I went to where they came from.
Sure.
And we met up there. But generally, because they're from all these different countries around the world, you don't see them until the next year's THU. But it doesn't seem like that long.
It doesn't seem like a year, right?
I bumped into somebody in the corridor on the way to this, and I haven't seen him since last year, and it doesn't seem like that long, you know.
Yeah.
But it's great because you can like go anywhere and you'll always see people you know. It's like everybody's so close-knit in here, you know.
Yeah.
It's not very like cliquey compared to some other industry events. Everybody's quite
no,
open.
No, and you know, all. That's something that's very important that Andre was telling us to say, this isn't about egos. Take your egos, put them away.
Well, like yesterday I was doing the sand sculpting thing, the team thing.
Yeah, and, yeah, you and I were the judges on it, which was awesome.
Yeah, Ian McKay was in our group,
uh-huh.
and I didn't know it was him
uh-huh.
until after it, because I don't know what he looks like.
Okay.
So I was like, you know, sculpting this thing in the sand for 3 hours with one of the concept artists from Star Wars and Harry Potter. And it wasn't until afterwards when Jose told me
uh-huh.
that it was Ian McKay, and I was like, what? You know, it's like, it was the same with Ian McHugh last year.
Yeah.
You know them as people first, and then you find out what they did, because a lot of people don't really project their likeness out there, so you don't know what they look like.
Right.
They're just people until you find out about what they do. And I like meeting people in that manner.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not only about the speakers, because the level of the attendees is also mind-blowing.
It is. And, you know, they're so inspiring. Even the youngest ones and the ones that are just starting off. Do you guys remember last year Scott was doing a talk? It was during his fireside chat or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about, remember, he kept talking about his love for music and music and music. And, mm-hmm. and then, you know, he never became a musician, or he was a musician for a little bit, but he never really sort of made that happen. And this girl said, you know, the way that you talk about animation, and the way you talk about music is the way that I think of animation. If I could not be in animation, I don't know what I would do. And it was a very heartbreaking moment. Like, she basically like just opened up in front of 600 people and had this thing, and you could tell she was just choked up and just like shy, very young person just starting out in this field. And I just felt so bonded to her and so wonderful that she said that. And Scott gave the best response ever. He goes, oh, don't worry about it. He says, mm-hmm. so if you're not good at it, there's other things you can do and still be involved. You know, you can work in different areas of animation. You could be a producer in animation. And it says, worst case scenario, you could watch a lot of animation.
Says, yes,
I listen to a lot of music, is what he said, you know. And it's fine. Celebrate it the way you want to celebrate. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you have to.
I guess everyone remembers that moment. Yeah.
Do you know if she's here this year?
Really?
I said, do you know if she's here?
I don't know. I don't remember her name. I just remember her voice. Oh. Yeah. So I'm sure it'd be great to follow up with her to find out what happened.
Mm.
But actually, let's go, speaking of the past, we should probably let people know a little bit about your backgrounds and how you guys got involved in doing what you're doing. So I know that you started in, this has kind of been a joke on a podcast, as you know, because we ever, a lot of people start in ArcViz, like almost comically. So what you were an ArcViz person. When did you sort of start doing some 3D?
Well, I have a degree in architecture.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, me too. Yep. And back in 1996, I started my own company for doing architectural visualization. It was not so common back then.
No, we were still not at all.
Breaking the ground,
yep.
Trying to convince people how useful it was,
yeah,
and convincing clients to pay for it.
Yes.
Right? And for about 15 years, I had that company.
Oh, okay.
And I just grew up doing architectural visualization, and that's where my connection with V-Ray appeared, because that was our render engine, and it was where I grew as an artist. To, as you know, there are many things that you do in ArcViz that are common to what you do in all the other type of industries, especially regarding materials, light, all that is common ground.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when I left ArcViz and decided to dedicate myself to my passion, which is actually characters.
Uh-huh.
I brought all that knowledge from ArcViz and applied it to character design.
Okay.
So that's how I brought, for example, V-Ray to my pipeline and kept working with it.
Right.
Until today.
Yeah. But so when you got into character design, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was the thing that drove you towards that, that really sort of made you want to do it?
I think I wouldn't say passion for architecture, because as artists, while I was a little kid, I drew a lot and I liked, and I always loved characters, and usually you're pushed by your family, if you know how to draw, then maybe you should be an architect.
Uh-huh.
You know? And pretty soon after having my degree in architecture, I found out that was not really my love.
Okay.
And I really loved technical stuff and the 3D part of it.
Right.
So I put together the 3D and the architecture. That's why I made the architectural visualization company.
Right.
But the passion for characters was always there. However, there was kind of a turning moment when after my company got successful, and that was about, let's say, the company had already 10 years, I was managing a force of 25 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was no longer doing what I liked.
Okay.
So basically, you're pushed to the Excel, to the emails, to
right.
the client contact, and all of a sudden the fun part,
yeah, it's gone away.
It got away. So I had this kind of urge of starting to do what I really loved at home during nights, and mm-hmm. then developing this character creation process.
Which is funny, you're escaping your job at home, but it was your own company.
Exactly. You should be able to control what you do, but sometimes you can't.
Yeah.
You can't. And then in this process of starting to post my work online and all that, I participated in a challenge, an online challenge that mm-hmm. was very well known at the time. It was the CG Society's challenge. At the time, the prizes were really big. And I won the challenge.
Wow.
I won the first prize. And for just a very brief moment, the spotlights were on me.
Right.
So, and the piece that won was very character driven, and some work opportunities started showing up.
Right.
And that was the kind of a pivotal moment. I had to choose, will I continue doing what I do with my company, or should I just embrace my passion?
Right.
And as I had more partners in the company, I just took that leap of faith,
mm-hmm.
and I told them, I sold my part of the company and started freelancing.
Right.
And ever since, that was 5 years ago, I've only been working on characters, so the passion was always there.
Right. And you're doing fairly well. You're able to do a lot of concept art for character works, and 5 years as a freelance concept artist.
Sure, it's not... I'm more a character designer and character modeler.
Right.
I get to do sometimes my own concepts. Sometimes I work with other people's concepts, which is kind of a really nice balance, because
right.
you get to invent your own stuff but learn from other people's stuff.
Sure.
So it's kind of great. And lately I've done not only 3D illustration, but a lot of artwork collectibles and sculpture.
Right.
Always with characters.
Right. And your background had something to do with, you were using something on an Amiga a long time ago. I remember that in part of your story, right, Andrew?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You were working on an Amiga. I remember something.
Yeah. When I first started off, I mean, I always wanted to be a cartoonist, but when I had my first computer, which was like an Amstrad, you know,
right.
When we upgraded from an Amstrad to an Amiga,
mm-hmm.
I found out that there was a science fiction TV on the there was a science fiction program on the TV at the time. This was like mid-90s.
Yeah, called Babylon 5.
Babylon 5.
Right?
And I found out that the effects for that were done using Lightwave on an Amiga.
Yeah.
And I had an Amiga, and for me that was mind-blowing that I had... Well, it wasn't the same because obviously they had these high-spec machines, but I had the same kind of machine that could do their effects. So that like got me into 3D and it made me want to try doing my own stuff.
Right.
And Amiga Format magazine had a floppy disk on it, which came with some software that worth like £250.
Right.
Which now is just like ridiculous.
Right.
So I installed it, had a go at it, just trying out things, you know, like doing the classic... old school 3D stuff like a chrome sphere on a checkerboard and all that stuff like that. And I just realized that that was the potential of 3D.
Right.
But as I was growing up and you had like games like Wipeout on the PlayStation and I loved the graphic design in it, like the logos and the typography. And that was done by a company called the Designers Republic.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I wanted to do because the mid to late 90s was so cool for graphic design. There was all this like really interesting, like cool stuff going around. So I did graphic design for 3 years at university.
Okay.
And as I reached the third year, it dawned on me that that's not what I wanted to do because the reality of graphic design for me in the West Midlands in the UK was like quite dull.
Right.
You know, like you'll be designing double page spreads for a local garbage collection company, you know.
Right.
It's just like it wasn't cool or sexy or anything, and it's just a bit utilitarian.
Okay.
So all the time I was doing this, I was doing 3D as a hobby.
Okay.
And I realized that that's what I truly wanted to do.
Right.
Because at the time Toy Story came out and I was like, that's it, this is the future, this is what I want to do.
Uh-huh.
So straight after university I pursued my interest in characters and 3D graphics and just basically went from there, and I got 3DS Max and I started getting better and better.
Yeah.
More trial and error, you know. My first characters didn't have fingers, they just kind of had like these stumpy mitten things because I didn't know how to model fingers. But the more you do it, the better I was getting at it. And
right.
As games were getting better, you know, like Virtua Fighter, it had like the characters had fingers, and then you had Tekken where the characters, their arms were joined to the body rather than being like separate sausage shapes. You know, as the game's technology was getting better,
yeah.
I was getting better because you were inspired by all these things that you play and you see. And yeah, I just realized that I really wanted to do character modeling. And after I left university, I applied for a job doing graphic design at a local design company. They were mostly an animation company, and I went under the pretense that I was going to be doing graphic design, but they realized pretty early on that 3D was what I really wanted to do.
Right.
So that kind of got my foot in the door. That was my first job in the industry. And then once you get your first job, you're kind of sorted because you've already got experience. And then after that, I went on to work full-time for an animation company doing a few like kids' TV things.
Uh-huh.
That company went down, so I went to another place doing kids' TV stuff. And I just kind of got a bit disillusioned with doing kids' TV stuff because it's all like very controlled and you can't do this and you can't do that and it's all twee and the designs are quite safe, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, so I've always been interested in pin-ups and like the female form from a sort of stylized and animated perspective.
Right.
Pretty much ever since Roger Rabbit, since I was a young age.
Yeah.
So I started like doing like some experimenting with like some character stuff as personal work.
Well, tell me, okay, because you guys both have a very different style, right? I mean, I'm talking about two character people that it's like you would clearly, this person and this person are not all in the same area, but you guys have such a unique way of looking at things. The way that you look at your pinups is a really interesting way, and the way that you create these very interesting charismatic characters that are not at all like a pinup, you know, but mm-hmm. they're really kind of interesting as well. But what is interesting to me is that you sort of embraced what is something that's a style that's defined already, right? You mm-hmm. took you and there's a lot of history towards pinups, and you talked about that in your presentation last mm-hmm. year. It was like this is a form that was almost, you know, a form of, and I think it is a form of art, and I think now it is celebrated as an important form of mm-hmm. art. But this was a very pulpy thing back in the day. You know,
it's never really been. I'm not a very highbrow artist. You know, it's like when it comes to like sort of chin stroking arty stuff, I just kind of like roll my eyes a little bit. So for me, I've always been into like pulp artwork, pinup, fetish, burlesque,
right,
pop culture. You know, like that kind of like lowbrow kind of imagery. So sure. It's just a very visual thing. There are no really like hidden messages behind it, and that's kind of what I like. But there's so many ways to approach it, and so many different personas and different personalities that you can employ with the artwork and how it's presented and how it's posed, and it's nice. It's a nice challenge.
Yeah, I think it is. What inspired you in terms of your style and the way that you do things? What sort of was some of the inspiration that brought you into what you came up with?
Well, I think my biggest inspiration are comics, actually.
Are comics?
Yes, because if you look at some of my images, many people say that they don't feel like 3D; they feel more like illustrations.
Yes,
right. And that's how I feel about them, and even the mental process behind them. It has to do with illustration. Mm-hmm. When I'm placing a light there, I'm not trying to think if it's physically correct or not. Mm-hmm. I'm just, for example, trying to get that silhouette at that point, or that the light hits the ear on that point so that it's visible, or that it contrasts with the background. Even the colors I use or some elements in the background are all there just to favor the composition, the overall composition of the image. It's not about creating something very realistic, but actually creating something very contrasty, colorful, with a very clear silhouette. They're all concepts that come more from the comics and illustration background than the photorealistic architectural visualization style.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it's mainly from comics, for sure.
Okay.
Very hard, art-edged.
But they are hard contrast. Yeah, exactly. And your lighting is very contrasted and, mm-hmm. and has a lot of, I mean, even the fur on it almost looks sharp, you know, mm-hmm. because it's got you can feel the coarseness, right?
Exactly.
And so it's not, you know, like the rabbit one, which is one of my favorite. It's not a fluffy rabbit. Mm-hmm. It's not. He's a rough rabbit.
And if you notice, if you look at, for example, at the outline of the rabbit, uh-huh. all the fur was kind of trimmed in a way that you can, that his silhouette is very hard.
Uh-huh.
Even though it's fur, if you put just the silhouette of the rabbit with all his fur, you'll feel that you have lines around his cheeks, or the way that the leg ends, or you just have those S curves and C curves, mm-hmm. that stuff that from illustration,
right?
You know, it's just like a 2D drawing made by this 3D fur,
right? Exactly,
the concept behind it.
Yeah, I think it's a really cool style. One of the things I think was also interesting is the composition of how you put the frame, because there's a lot of things about composition that are always an interesting part of things. Most people think of composition in terms of where you put your subject and compose it into the image. But one of the things I loved about your presentation is you're composing the shapes of the female form in different ways, and talking about all the ways that you can change that shape, right? So there was something about like, you can make the butt really big, and you can make the boobs really big, and and the S curve. You can get try to slope here and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I like to do with my work is I like to vary my style.
Right.
Because if you do the same thing all the time, I think it can get a bit boring. And because it's such a diverse subject with so many different body types and different ways to approach it, is that sometimes you'll have like a sort of a small cute character with a big head and like stumpy arms mm-hmm. and legs, or sometimes you'll do like a more realistic one, or sometimes you'll do a realistic one with sort of a blend of sharp and soft edges.
Yeah.
And then even within those kind of subcategories, you can then sort of say, oh, this girl's got really wide hips, or she's got big thighs, or she's skinny, or she's tall. And it's just an interesting way to make what would normally be something like fairly pedestrian, you know, just like a girl standing there. Mm-hmm. You can make it more interesting by sort of stylizing the body shapes and celebrating, I wouldn't say imperfections, but whatever makes a girl unique, mm-hmm. you enhance that. You don't kind of shy away from it. So if somebody's got a little bit of a belly or like some like bulgy hips, mm-hmm. I find that attractive in a sort of unique way because that's what makes them them.
Right.
You don't airbrush over them and make everybody perfect because then everything just looks a bit bland.
Of course.
You give them personality through the parts of their body that make them them.
Yes.
Even the faces. If somebody's got like a broad nose or a wide nose or like a square jaw or something, I find that interesting because it's what makes them unique.
Right.
You know, generally pinup is very controlled and it's very everybody has to look perfect and flawless and mm-hmm. within the set ideals. But one thing I quite like to do is if somebody's got something about them, whether if they're physically perfect or not, it doesn't matter. If they've got a presence and they've got something that inspires me, I like to portray that in my artwork.
Yeah.
Because it's what makes them unique and what makes them have a presence, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think another thing that I like about both of you guys is sometimes is the idea that you can look at an image and you can derive all this personality from this character, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, as an example, like one of the things I loved is you created these two girls that were friends, like the high school,
yeah.
you know, but you told this whole narrative. You've made up this entire story about these two fictional people, mm-hmm. and it's all through like just a couple of images in them.
I don't normally make stories behind my characters. I normally just assign them a name, do some poses to portray their personality, but because I think it was there's a French artist that lives in London called Macbeth, mm-hmm. and he's one of my favorite artists, and he does a lot of his pinups and girls in like American like high school kind of clothes, you know, like those black and white varsity jackets.
Right.
And my sole starting point for that was just to do a pinup wearing a varsity jacket.
Right.
So I made Candy, who's the sort of the thin, moody, aloof, like sort of high school badass.
Right.
And then I thought it'd be interesting to sort of make a completely contrasting character just to offset that. Initially, I was going to make them like rivals, kind of like
right.
good versus evil sort of thing. But then I realized that they work well as a pair and sort of thought it'd be cool if they were friends, but
they're the odd
they've
couple.
Got completely opposite personalities.
Right.
And it's nice to sort of do that because so many people, especially people that are kind of like fresh out of college and like starting off, they've got a lot of technical skills and they make the characters look really cool, but they don't do a lot with them.
Right.
So for me, I find it more important to take a character, to pose it, to give it personality, to give it life, to give it a story behind it, because it's not just a model then, it's a character and it's come to life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite important.
Yeah, I just love seeing some of the characters. Like obviously, yeah, we mentioned the rabbit, how I love, because I just look at that rabbit, I was like, oh, that's a badass rabbit.
It's really good expression on that one.
Yeah, and he's got all the attitude, and then you know, once you just right off the bat, you can look at it, and he's just a pissed off rabbit. You know?
Exactly,
but
it's the gesture,
like
the cigarette, and
yeah.
Everything.
But he's French, I'm assuming, because he looks French.
He has
the south of France, probably
the French arrogance.
Yeah, see, he does.
I'd say it's like. Well, I don't know. I just
to me, he's a Frenchman, right, from the south of France, somewhere from Marseille. He used to be, you know, one of the legionnaires.
Every time
like
an art critic, maybe.
Yeah, an art critic. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Every time I described the rabbit, it was like an art connoisseur.
Yeah. So, but he also's got that earring. So he used to be in a band before. You know what I mean? Like he's like somehow there's something about him that was there that's different. But yeah, he is definitely a character.
Yeah, when I do my character, actually, when I was here at THU and on the first edition,
uh-huh.
I was also a speaker and actually my
You did the poster for the first THU, right?
Yes,
yeah.
With Serge's concept for
the
unicorn. But my lecture here was exactly about character design and the first thing I talked about was exactly about the story behind. The importance of the story behind the character or feeling. When you look at a character, you've got to feel. It's like exactly like architectural visualization.
Right.
When you create something like that looks completely new, you try to do the as if it doesn't have a past. Like all the walls are all pristine white. And
right.
It just doesn't feel right.
You're so right. And we've talked about this before. I think one of the things that's important is narrative, right?
Exactly.
And so when you're showing architecture, especially in the rendering portion of thing, the whole point is you've been to architecture school and stuff, you put the rendering up, and what you're doing is you're presenting a story, right? And so when you do a series of renderings, it's a storyboard. You're saying, this is where this happens, this is where this happens. So you've created a complete narrative through pictures, and they have to sort of stand out on their own.
And
right?
I'm also talking about the story within a single picture. Like, usually clients don't like that in architectural visualization, but it's so that people feel that the space has been used,
yes.
that people have been there. It's a little bit humanized, even if it's just a jacket yep. falling from a chair, or that you have the outside and you have some leaves falling on the ground from autumn.
Do you remember Dwell magazine? Do you ever get Dwell magazine over here? Okay,
no.
It's an architecture magazine called Dwell, and it's really nice. Mm-hmm. I remember first versions that came out probably sometime in the it was late 90s. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in this magazine, it was the first time I'd seen an architecture magazine, not their Architecture Digest, all the other stuff, mm-hmm. where they had people in the images.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, there'd be like a rendering, you know, not a rendering, but it was a photograph of this piece of architecture in a house,
mm-hmm.
and the people that lived there were in the picture. Mm-hmm. You know, they were in the background cooking.
Yes, it was very uncommon.
Yeah, that's not common. And mm-hmm. but it was... there was a narrative to that. It's
exactly.
Like, this is, I can see this person having breakfast here as opposed to a cold place, mm-hmm. you know? So I think you're right. When you tell a narrative, it's important to put that in the images that you put out there.
The character, if the character has lived through a series of experiences, is here in a certain moment, when you take an image of that character, he's in a certain moment in time. So
right.
there is a past behind him, and he has a certain personality, and that should show in the image of the character.
Yeah.
If he was a warrior, for example, a fighter for all his life, and a wrestler, he'd probably have cauliflower ears, for example.
Right.
You know, that's a sign of something in his past. There was something that shaped what he is in the present.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what the kind of thing I try to bring to my characters. The past must be present.
Yeah.
In the present.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think some of the things that I like about your characters is you tend to be able to tell a huge amount of story with way less shape than most people want to get into. Like, some people want to really get into shapes and texture and stuff like that. You tend to minimize as much of it as possible in a lot of ways, I think is really kind of interesting, because it allows you to form a complete idea of a person and yet still offer enough for your mind to fill in whatever. You know, I'm sure if someone looks at a picture, some of the renderings, what I think of that person is going to be different than someone else. But there is a story that I've made in my mind very quickly based on seeing that, because the shape is just kind of working that way.
Well, I think in brutal honesty, the main reason for that is probably due to laziness.
Well,
it's like I don't have a lot of patience to make things really detailed and to put a lot of modeling detail and textural detail in them, and I just tend to prefer more stylized and simplistic illustrations, because the vast majority of the stuff that I'm really inspired by are like simple and cartoon kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like I tried, as Jose was saying earlier, it's like he's inspired by comics, so he wants to do things that look illustrative, and that's exactly what I try to do as well, because I always wanted to be a cartoonist when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But my drawing skills kind of never really developed that much.
Right.
So I kind of use 3D as a means to an end to make the sort of images that I would like to see, which is sort of, because a lot of 3D images tend to have a similar look about them. You know, they've all got like that very sort of deep, richly textured, vibrant kind of look. And I mean, that's great, but I like to do things that are like a lot more flat looking. So mm-hmm. I use like, you know, like narrow, almost like orthographic camera projections to make things look flat rather than like very 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I use very contrasting lighting. Sometimes I even just use no lighting and maybe just like a shader with a fall off on it, so it's flat, but it's got a little bit of something on the edge.
Right.
And it's, I think to be able to do to make an effective image with little is great, you know, because it's, for me, it's like less is more.
Right.
Like if you can tell the story and you can make a character using the minimum amount of I was going to say effort, but again, that sounds lazy. But it's like if you can make a character using the minimum amount of detail,
right,
then that's kind of like a challenge, because people do that all the time in cartoons.
Yeah.
And illustration is they take something, they simplify it, but it's still got a lot of character.
Right.
And that's what I like to do.
Yeah. I think go ahead,
Jose. No, I just think Andrew is actually very modest regarding his work.
Yeah.
But one of the things that... the way you simplify things is actually not simple at all.
Right.
Because one of the biggest challenges when you're doing simpler characters is like to find what is the essence of the character and, yes, what is the minimal line, for example, that represents something.
If you only have one line to do something, that line takes a lot of time to get it the right shape.
It's like my all-time favorite artist is a guy called Shane Glines. He's a 2D illustrator and cartoonist that works at Warner Brothers.
Uh-huh.
And he was largely responsible for the look, along with Bruce Timm, of the Superman and Batman animated TV series.
Okay.
And although I'm not into like comic books and Batman, it's not really what I like that much, but I do absolutely love his style. And he's, in my opinion, the absolute master of taking a pinup or pretty much any kind of character and simplifying them into such appealing silhouettes and shapes using the minimum amount of detail.
Mm-hmm.
It'll just like take their shoulders or their waist or their hips or their face, and it'll like cut it right back down to the bare minimum, but it's still got a hell of a lot of appeal, and in some cases it's the likeness as well, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just a master at simplifying things, and I find that really inspiring.
Yeah, I think
it's so easy these days, especially if you're using a program like ZBrush, to keep adding detail. And for me, I like to reduce detail, or to try and do what I can with the least amount of detail, basically.
Actually, for me, the ideal character would be like, to start the way he's saying, like going to the essence of the character, getting his minimal lines,
yeah,
to define what really defines the shape, and that would be the ideal base for detailing.
Right.
You know, it's like sort of, you create the base like he does, and then you can add the detail on top. So you'll have something, a very LC foundation of your sculpture.
Yeah.
And sometimes people just start adding detail without having an appealing or sound foundation.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was quite interesting, because there's a friend of mine, and she inspires me quite a bit. So I did two different illustrations based on her.
Uh-huh.
And the first one I did was like just a head and shoulders bust that I did in ZBrush.
Right.
And because it was straight from the get-go, all in ZBrush, it was quite detailed and quite sort of, not realistic because it was a caricature, but it was quite sculpted looking and quite like, you know, it had like creases on the lips and stuff like that. But I did another one recently, a few months ago, where I tried to do the same thing, but using as little detail as I can to make it look flat and illustrative. Mm-hmm. And the way that I started out was I basically made like a capsule shape,
mm-hmm,
put some balls on there for the eyes, mm-hmm, some balls for the cheeks and the chin, like a donut shape for the mouth, you know, just making this really simple, like, yeah, cartoon head. And I'm trying to get the likeness in the least amount of detail as I can.
Yeah.
And then once I got a likeness using these like sausage shapes and balls and whatever, I then made the model on top of that, like using like a single mesh. So I was trying to do the caricature and get the likeness with the least amount of shapes that I possibly could. And that was quite an interesting exercise, because I don't normally work that way.
Right. Yeah, I think it is. I don't know if you've followed some of the things that I've been doing in the last, but I started a project called the Wiki Human Project.
Yes, I've read a little bit about it, and I know that project.
So have you heard anything about it, Andrew?
No.
Okay, well, I'll go through. I'll show you after this some of the stuff I've done, we're basically doing an open source human project where we're getting a bunch of people together, and we're working on them. We're calling the Digital Human League, and we've got like people like Paul Dubevic and Mike Seymour from FX Guide, and a bunch of Steve Prieg. He worked on Benjamin Buttons and stuff, mm-hmm, like that. So we're trying to create the most realistic face possible, right? And so, but we're trying to tackle it both from the artistic side, because we've got several artists as well as the science side of things. But I want to solve the science problems to minimize the variables for the artists, so that we've scanned a face. We did a new scan, but we're getting down to 10 microns of detail. So really, really, really small details. So we have 16K displacement maps for the face, for the skin. Mm-hmm. So we get between the pores, we get all the creases between the pores. Mm-hmm. And so it's unbelievable amount of detail that goes into that. And the more you add the detail, if it's good and it adds all this richness, et cetera, but if you don't have the right exact shape, then it's not going to work, you know? And that's an important part of that realization. Like, you probably are looking at the macro, at the macro level at a person all the time. You're looking at the macro thing and spending a huge amount of time in that area, which is, I think, critical, that sometimes I feel is missing in what we're doing on the project. Because I think the uncanny valley problem, people keep adding more details and not necessarily looking back at the macro as well.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the micro detail, but and the latest revelation in my life regarding characters and character skin, which actually has to do with your project, was when you talk about the micro wrinkles,
yeah,
and the pores and the way they have. Usually, when you do like a specular map for skin and all that, you tend to think of things like, okay, the nose is shinier, the places where bone is in contact with the skin will be shinier, the softer parts will probably be more diffuse.
Yeah.
And what happens is that in fact, with the micro wrinkles, the wrinkles will change shape according to the expression of the face.
Right. So all the roughness is done in the geometry for real.
Exactly. So as you open the mouth, probably as the muscle of the cheeks stretch up, you'll get more elongated wrinkles.
Yeah.
And if you like doing any other shape, yep, they will change shape. So actually, the specularity and anisotropy of the specular will change according to the position and of the pose of the face, and that cannot be static.
No.
So, and usually when you do maps for games and all that, you do it in a static way.
Right.
So this is something that people have to break through, is create dynamic speculars or dynamic anisotropy that is related to the morph targets or the way the faces change, the expression changes.
Exactly. And just in the same way that Andrew is trying to find the most minimal thing you need to define the character, that's what I'm trying to do with the skin shader, in a mm-hmm. sense. Our skin shader is as simple as possible for a reason. I want to get to the minimum kind of thing that we want to do in the WikiHuman project. We're using Phong for our specular model. That's mm-hmm. about as simple as it is. Mm-hmm. Phong. So it's like, you know, a lot of people say, oh, we need a Cook-Torrens shader here. We need to be able to do a GGX or whatever you want to do to try to get all that macro facet detail, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. But we're getting that for real from the scan. So we want to make a simple, simple, simple process. So
it's funny you should mention that, because quite a lot of people email me and ask me, what skin shader do you use? Like, show me your shader setup. And most of the time, I'll just use a standard V-Wave material with a low specularity. And that's all you need to make it.
Yeah, you don't even use subsurface, right?
Sometimes I do, but because I'm not a very technical artist, I always struggle to get a good look with subsurface scattering.
Right.
I mean, sometimes it works, and sometimes it works how I want it to, but more often than not, it doesn't look an awful lot different to a standard V-Wave shader with the kind of lighting that I use. And it, because I want to do more simplistic-looking stylized characters.
Right.
I think it works well, you know.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And I think it's fine. I think the fact that you just want to use the simple things.
I think also a lot of the films out there, they tend to have a trend of making really simplistic looking faces, but with really realistic looking skin. And I'm not sure what to think of that, because if you take like a really cartoony looking head mm-hmm. that looks like something from like a 1960s Hanna-Barbera cartoon, like really stylized, and then you put like pores and wrinkles and freckles and subsurface, it kind of looks a bit creepy, I think.
Yeah.
If you're making something that's stylized, it helps to make the shade is stylized as well.
Sure.
It's like probably The Incredibles is probably the furthest I've ever liked it to go, because they still look cartoony, but they've still like got feasible looking skin. But right. It's not too real, you know.
Yeah, and they've got a nice subsurface to them, right? And it's not, it's a different kind of subsurface than I've seen in other things. I think that's sort of at a time when there was different types of things that were going on and stuff. But it's a really nice subsurface the way that I did it, you know, and it felt soft, but it didn't feel too soft. They didn't feel like gummy bears, right?
You know? I think one of the main reasons why The Incredibles worked really well is because the lighting, I mean, it's aged a little bit now, you know. Is it like 12 years old, is it?
Yeah,
2004. But it's aged a little bit, but it still looks great because they were quite restrained with the lighting these days.
But like, they also went for a specific type of style of architecture.
Yeah, the sort of 1950s sort of futurism.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things is if you see films like Toy Story or almost any film from Pixar, the fact that they stylize so much make them so much more enduring in time in terms of style. When you're trying to break the uncanny valley, you know, everything you do 1 year, the next year gets beaten by another film and another film. And right, then 5 years later, you look back and things that looked so good at the time are not looking so good anymore because you're...
But I think the Uncanny Valley is still like ridiculously hard to break. If I look at Benjamin Button's right now, it still looks amazing to me. But then there's also a whole bunch of other stuff that happened since Benjamin Button's that got worse, you know, and then some of it got better again. And then now it's like, you know, it's a very different thing. And the problem is that it's the problem. I don't know what's wrong, but I know something's wrong, right? And that's a hard thing to crack. I want to define that. You know, it's part of like, you know, one of the jokes about not the jokes, but one of the discussions we're having in the Digital Human League is you know, saying, well, what do we need to get out, make sure we're outside of the Uncanny Valley? And I was like, well, that's fine. I'm more interested in finding out why the Uncanny Valley exists in the first place. You know, what is it that What are the features that are going wrong that is affecting it so that it goes into the Uncanny Valley? And why do you feel, you know, your emotions, why are they so weirded out by this character, right? There's a flight or flight kind of scenario that goes on with that area because you don't feel safe. But I think that that's a strange thing. Like, what about this person feels threatening?
Yeah, I think it's because we're so used to seeing people in all walks of life all day, every day, that if there's just something slightly off about them, you kind of like, you feel a bit intrigued by it. And
right.
It's just, yeah, so it's so difficult to make, to do something that you believe that they're a real person because we're so used to seeing them. It's been discussed like a million times anyway, so yeah, I'm just like repeating what...
No, I know, but yeah, but okay, but let's relate it back to some of your stuff because I think I see it, and I talk about this all day long, so it's cool. But you are looking at people's imperfections in real life, right, and enhancing them. So you're taking something, and that's part of the caricature aspect, right, is you enhance imperfections, and that's what makes their character grow. So you're almost freeing yourself of some of those issues, and I think what... The thing is that I guess the imperfections are too subtle, or just maybe that's what it is. Like, where is the imperfection? Are we making it too subtle and it's not subtle enough? Or is it like, you know, there's a range, you know, like maybe you could graph it like a lot of people have, but finding out how much of an imperfection gets enhanced and de-enhanced and doesn't affect it. Because I think that's actually
but I also think that, for example, exactly like if you get the super average person, like if you try to represent what would be the average of everyone, may also, and it's very symmetrical and all that will also look very creepy.
Yes.
So I guess we have to admit that the imperfection is necessary for the...
Yes.
For the realism.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really interesting. We were... Gina and I were talking this morning about something, and I brought up... Bradley Cooper, the actor Bradley Cooper, and I mentioned that there was a thing that we were working on, and we had some a lot of images of Bradley Cooper at a Digital Domain at the time, and I looked at him and he's like, wow, good looking guy, women love Bradley Cooper. He has got one of the most asymmetrical faces I've ever seen. Like, just very asymmetrical and very unusual. And there's a lot of imperfections in him. I was like, I think that's probably why he looks so cool, because he's got all these imperfections. If he had everything normal about him, it would be very, like, different.
Yeah, it's Benedict Cumberbatch. Some people think he looks really strange, but, like, I think he's fascinating because he's just got one of those, like, really interesting faces. He's got a very charismatic, unique-looking face. And I don't normally do many portraits or pictures of guys in my personal work because, you know, I've got a big passion for pinup stuff, but I had to do one of Benedict Cumberbatch because he just has such an interesting
face. Have you done one already, or...?
Second?
Have you done one?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I don't know if I've seen that one.
I just went through a bit of a binge. I was watching a lot of Sherlock, and I just wanted to do a picture of Cumberbatch because he's kind of like an alien, but like a beautiful alien. It's probably the best way to describe
him. He's a beautiful alien. I like that. Yeah.
But I would also think that, for example, about this is a very interesting subject about imperfections making someone more attractive. I would say that would be possible, for example,
let's start with that idea, right? I think the problem is that we call it perfection versus imperfection, and we can call it symmetry versus asymmetry, or, you know, features that are different, you know, but that's the thing is we in the back of our minds, we're thinking they're imperfections.
I think
someone's nose is crooked doesn't mean that it's not perfect.
We've always assumed that symmetry is like a sign of health.
Right.
Usually.
Yes.
And that's why I think the caveman, that when you have someone that's very symmetrical, usually it means that it has developed in an healthy way.
Right.
And that's how we choose our partners.
Right.
Instinctively. I want someone symmetrical because it's healthy. It will give me healthy babies.
Right.
That would be the... But when you are asymmetrical, let's say, if you're asymmetrical and that asymmetry suggests an expression... Let's say, imagine that you have an eyebrow that's slightly higher than the other.
Yes.
And that suggests that you always have that cocky look.
Right.
You know? So if that is permanent, that can also affect the way other people perceive your personality.
Yes.
Because it's an asymmetry that will give a sign about your personality.
Yes.
And that can make someone attractive despite the fact that it's asymmetrical.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And that's the thing... We're not talking about a deformity, right? We're talking about something else. And the deformity is a thing that I think that people you're talking about specifically when you're talking about the evolution of caveman.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm not attracted to someone with a big deformity, you know?
Because exactly.
That person's not going to produce healthy babies with me, you know? Yeah. So I think, but it's, there is something about the expression, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right that a neutral face that has an expression is kind of interesting as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I always like to see like interesting features in certain people. I think that's what makes them attractive to me, because I follow quite a lot of models on Facebook because I get a lot of my inspiration from you know, like burlesque and fetish and pinup models and illustrators and stuff like that. And, you know, I think a few months back there was a model on there and she posted a really nice photo and everybody was like going on, wow, nice outfit and, you know, your ass looks amazing and all these usual sort of comments like that. But I was saying, your nose looks really cool in this picture.
Right.
And she was kind of like a bit like weirded out by that, but she said she appreciates it because... It's not a compliment that she's had before, but if somebody's got an interesting feature about them.
Well, see, that's the thing. Okay, you say, you know, like you said, it's like, I love the pinup thing, but there is something sexy about what you do, but it's not about sex.
No.
You know what I mean? It's about like, that's sexy. In fact, it's sexy in a way that you're almost more, you're less lustful for your images and more in love with the images.
Yeah, pretty much. It's not just a base visual thing. It's projecting the personality.
Yeah. I look at these girls and I'm like, look at them and it's like, yeah, you're taking the girl. And like you said, a lot of them have imperfections in true life, right? And you've basically says, those are awesome. I love this for you. And this is my tribute back to you of that person. And it's not like, yeah.
I think a lot of them, I mean, some of them will be classed as imperfections, but most of the time it's more like unique features.
No, yeah, exactly. That's features.
You know, like if
like her nose is really cool. So you could, that thing is going to become something interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know that when you said that, your nose is really cool. It wasn't like because you were trying to be weird. I think
that was the strange thing, because like I like to support other artists, and I see models and photographers and fashion designers as artists as well. So I like to support their work. So obviously, when the person in these photos in a pinup models page is the person themselves,
right,
and you give them a compliment, which is also a compliment about them rather than their artwork,
right,
it's more personal for them. So when you say something like, your nose looks really cool here, it's like it affects them more, because it's them. It is who they are. And, you know, it's,
sure.
And it's different to what they usually hear, because you get some really like sort of misogynistic, crass people like saying dat ass or something, you know,
right.
And then to be complimented on something that they're not used to, for something specific like that.
Yeah, it's well, because nice, she's used, know, to people with normal fetishes and not nose fetishes. But
I did say I'm not a nose fetishist.
No, it's not. Because you're basically, the whole idea is that you know, you're looking at her as a complete thing, as a complete idea, and there's features.
Yeah, it's all the nuances and the little tiny little things that make up the whole, not just the whole thing. It's like they have to have something about them.
Right.
You know, and I find that more attractive than whether if somebody's like, not wearing any clothes or anything. It's more like about how they project themselves and how they carry themselves than
right
the sort of the sex aspect of it, you know.
Yeah, I think it's really great. And you like I said, it's like you put in all the personality and stuff, and I love the idea. And then you see, you know, you have your friends that you make illustrations of them, and then there's a picture of them holding up the illustration of themselves.
It's always really rewarding when you see that, because when somebody inspires you, it just makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah, exactly. So is this basic? That's your day job now, doing most of these things, right?
Well, this all my pinup stuff, it's all my personal work.
Right.
I don't often get paid to do that, and I think that's why I always do pinup in my free time, because I don't do it as a job.
Okay.
My job is more like doing things for animation and sculpting things for toys and TV advertisements, illustration, but it's always like I don't usually get to do anything that's like quite pinup related, so that's why I tend to do that most of the time in my free time, because it's like an escape.
Okay.
That's why I started doing it in the first place, because I started off full time doing a lot of kids TV stuff, and obviously you can't do anything like that at all.
Right.
So I just did that as an escape from my paid work.
Right, right, right. But you're able to do concept and character stuff full time on your own now, right? In the last 5 years freelancing on
yes,
this.
Yes, actually, yes. In the beginning, I did more 3D illustration, because uh-huh. that's what I put out there. But then, as sculpting tools evolved, I got more and more in love with the sculpting process.
Yeah.
And then I had the opportunity of starting making collectibles and like stuff for toys. And that is almost 100% sculptural.
Sure.
And that's one of the parts that I love so much. That's what I've been doing on the last year, collectibles for stuff like DC characters, Marvel characters, and even television series characters, the things that I cannot talk about, but that will be released during next year. And so pretty much I've kind of like focused on the on that part of sculpture, which is so physical, I don't know, and software has now is in such a way that actually it's so far away from hard surface modeling, where you really feel that you're in contact with that matter, that digital matter,
right?
And I actually love sculpting, so I've been doing mostly working in that area.
Well, that's, and what do you sculpt with? You use ZBrush?
ZBrush, yes.
Yeah?
ZBrush.
Well, that's great. I used to be in modeling before I did, you know, when I started in VFX, I was doing building modeling, which obviously was architecture. And I kind of really like modeling, but I've gotten so, you know, when I got into lighting, it's fine. I was thinking about going back to modeling, but right around that time, ZBrush happened. And I was like, wow, this changed everything. Like the way the characters being made in ZBrush, it was like that. Done. That this is a whole new level of character stuff,
and allowed to bring new artists to the game. People that were not very technical, and that were very artist driven by art, like traditional sculptures that have an amazing set of skills and the way they perceive reality.
Yeah.
They can put all that with these sculpting tools, and they are actually being very successful at this new technology.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's really cool, and I think the way the characters are coming through is really interesting. And obviously, an event like this, you get to see a lot of that. You get to talk to a bunch of people about it, and you know, things used to be really complicated. I mean, I was talking to Alex Alvarez yesterday, mm-hmm. who I've known for a while from Nomad, but all of his characters, he did everything in NURBS patches. You know, think about it now, it's like, geez, I know, really, yeah. Really.
It's quite interesting because both me and Jose, we both use 3DS Max, and
yeah.
we're quite old school, kind of.
Yeah,
I'm still quite old school now because I'm struggling a little bit to adapt to ZBrush because it kind of throws the robot out the window. You know, it doesn't even have like a sort of Windows based kind of system where it's kind of like file preferences. It's all completely different.
No, it just basically took your brain and throw it away
Jose was saying, which is really good because for people that don't know about all the technical side of things and they don't have a background with the old-fashioned ways, like in 3DS Max, they can basically pick that up, learn its ways because that's all they know at the time. And it's intuitive if you've never used another piece of 3D software before because, as you were saying, it's like physical sculpting. So it's great for new people to pick up and people that have never used a 3D program before.
Yeah, if your mind isn't already polluted by the past.
It is intuitive and it is very hands-on and it makes sense, but you've got to adapt to its way. So when you're used to like box modeling and poly modeling, it's quite sort of difficult to adjust to the way that it wants to do things.
I had the same struggle when I decided I was going to look at SketchUp. I was looking at SketchUp and I was like, I'm looking for all the familiar tools and they're not there, you know? And it's like, no, it's just like boom, 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 built. Like, it's so like simple that it was hard for my mind to take care of that. But I know a lot of people make amazing stuff in SketchUp and they open up Max, for example, to me, which is like, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that to them, it's like they just learned to fly and you put them into an F-16 and they're like trying to figure out, whoa, what am I going to do, you know? Anyway, let's talk about what we're going to do at Trojan Horse for the next few days. Mm-hmm. What are you guys planning on doing?
In general or today? Or
yeah, I mean, what are things that you are excited about at this event that's coming up?
As I was saying earlier, it's because it's very like VFX and concept art related. It's not like truly my scene,
mm-hmm.
but there are some people here that I absolutely can't wait to meet and see. Kim Jung-gi, mm-hmm. for a reason. I'm just fascinated with his work because he almost seems to have like a savant like level of skill,
uh-huh.
and I just can't comprehend how it works. Like, he doesn't sketch things out and he could draw anything from any perspective and all the mechanical intricacies of it and all the details, and I'd just love to see him draw. His work's fascinating.
Wow, okay. Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Well, I'll be giving some of the mentorship sessions during the festival, in which I'll try to help some smaller group of people with whatever they want to know, but especially career counseling, freelance counseling, technical counseling. It's mostly about being their mentor.
Right.
And as in all other years, the speaker's level seems to just go high and high with each year. But I'm just expecting to be blown away. I guess that's the minimal thing you expect at the THU. And when you leave the festival, your batteries are supercharged. I have the privilege of having been a speaker and at the same time being the fan of the other speakers.
Yeah.
So I'm in a very special position, which is to be able to. There are people that come to me that like my work.
Yeah.
But I'm also a fan of the other speakers, so I'm in between that. Lets me experience the THU at a high dynamic range of experience.
Right.
I'm the fanboy and some people are fans.
I think that's kind of THU in a nutshell. It's like nobody is like a superstar because even the superstars get to mingle with other superstars, and the attendees are really passionate and their work's great as well. I mean, everybody's kind of like on the same level. Like even last year when Sid Mead was here, he was just walking around and you could just chat to him and he's like a legend.
Yeah.
And that happened on the first one.
But he was funny as hell. He was really funny. I was cracking up every time he talked because he just said the most insane things.
And in the first edition, before Scott Ross was involved in the process, because actually
Scott was a speaker.
Scott was one of the speakers.
Yeah.
And what was magical was that Scott was supposed to come and give his speech, and then he would go and play golf or whatever.
Right.
And he came and made the opening of the festival, and all of a sudden you saw Scott staying around, seeing other people's lectures. Then Scott sitting on the ground with four or five young people around him and talking during the happy hour breaks.
Right.
And then in the end, seeing that Scott fell in love with the event and going to talk to Andre and asking him if Andre would like him to be the ambassador of the festival.
Mm-hmm.
So if a guy like Scott Ross, with his experience and all that, was enchanted by the THU, yeah. I guess that says a lot.
It is, and I think it's hard for a lot of people to think about, because, you know, a lot of these speakers, they've been invited to do talks, and they do it, and they, you know, they get a nice VIP treatment, and they go and they get a nice dinner, and then they're whisked away, and then they fly home early because they're done with their lecture, right? And that doesn't happen here. Someone who's talking, you're here the whole week, you know, no matter what. Even if you're only talking once, you're here the whole week, and you are going to, your participation doesn't begin and end with your lecture. Your participation is about being part of the tribe.
And you're, no one is obliged to go to the other speaker's lectures, but the fact is that every speaker goes to the other speaker's lectures.
Right.
So the speakers give their lecture, and then they become attendees exactly. as they came out of the door.
Yep.
That was the thing. I mean, last year I was a speaker, and as Jose was saying, he tried to convince me to go to the very first THU.
Right.
But because I wasn't used to industry events, I didn't. But I was the speaker. I was a speaker last year. I'm not a speaker this year, but I'm still going, you know, because it's such a cool event. And
right. So this is, like you said, you don't like going to industry events, but you'll come to this one, right?
Yeah. That it was surprising, because I actually said to you at the last THU that we're on this beautiful peninsula surrounded by beaches and lovely weather. I don't want to sit in darkened rooms and listen to people talking about work. Mm-hmm. And he said, believe me, you will. And I did. I think I only spent about 20 minutes on the beach last year, and I spent all my time every part of every day watching the talks. You know,
the nature of the talk is completely different, right? It's not like, okay, here is my latest technique onto this. It was reality. It was what the reality of that person's life is, or what inspired them, and how they became what they became. And so it's it was very different. So, all right. So I think we're about a little over an hour, which is perfect. Mm-hmm. So how did that feel? Was that all right for you guys?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
Yes, it was great. And, I think we discussed some interesting subjects that I was not expecting to discuss.
I never know what's going to go. I don't have notes. I just sort of let it go. Because I always find it, you know, it's the same thing as when I was talking with people, I asked them if they want to be on a podcast, and I was like, oh, okay, well, what are we talking about? I was like, well, what are we talking about right now?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about the same stuff. Because I think people, for the listeners out there, what I love to do is I want to make them feel like they can be a fly on the wall and be part of it. And especially on this THU thing, you know, there is only 600 people that are here today that are coming to this event. And that's about as much as this thing can hold, right? That's the maximum. So I know they would be ashamed to not be able to share that with as many people as possible. So these podcasts that I'm doing here are going to be about sharing that so that people have an opportunity to participate in the discussions that we have, and at least on the listening side of things. So, all right, guys. So I'm going to let the last bucket drop, which is the closing of my podcast.
Okay.
And I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.